From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, our guest will be Rose Christian, and we'll be discussing osteoporosis, a silent disease which leads to spine and hip fractures, frequently disastrous events in the lives of their often elderly victims. We'll be looking at the causes and risk factors for osteoporosis and strategies to prevent it, and to prevent fractures more generally, and the important role lifestyle, especially nutrition and physical activity, play in preventing this major health problem. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The World Health Organization will examine whether the current international drug patent system prevents developing countries from obtaining needed medicines, vaccines, and diagnostic tests. The 192 members of the World Health Organization agreed at a meeting recently in Geneva to launch an intergovernmental group to identify important areas of medical research that are currently being neglected. They're also tasked to draw up a global strategy to ensure that the world's medical research establishment focuses enough resources on the health problems of the poor to create a knowledge base to treat health problems that are prevalent in the developing world. Back in April last year, the World Health Organization issued a report criticizing the existing drug development, marketing, and pricing system, saying it largely neglected the poor. The proposed effort will pick up where that document left off. The goal of the resolution is to ensure that the world's medical research agenda is driven by patients' needs and not simply profits. Authorities in the northern Chinese province of Hebei have shut down 201 medical clinics that were involved in identifying and aborting female fetuses since 2004. Authorities discovered 848 cases of gender selection in 745 health facilities. Thereafter, 374 of the facilities were fined, 104 medical workers had their licenses revoked, and 201 clinics were closed. It's illegal in China to abort a fetus at more than 14 weeks gestation. However, the procedure is widespread because of China's one-child-per-family policy, which has led to a gender imbalance. China recorded a boy-to-girl ratio of 117 to 100 in a 2000 census, compared with 108.5 to 100 in 1982. In some parts of Hebei, the ratio is 134 boys to 100 girls. Payments per beneficiary to Medicare HMO plans on average exceeded by 11% what the traditional Medicare fee-for-service program pays per individual, according to a new Medicare Payment Advisory Commission analysis released last week. According to the analysis, in 2004, Medicare paid 11% more to HMOs than it would have cost Medicare to simply pay for the care directly. In other words, to provide the traditional Medicare benefit. The study took into consideration both demographic and geographic factors. The analysis was prepared at the request of congressional committees to update previous reports. Of note, all five previous reports studying the issue reached the identical conclusion, that attempts to privatize Medicare by subcontracting to private insurers and HMOs significantly raises the costs to Medicare, rather than saving money for the program. The study commission actually estimated that the loss to Medicare was even greater than 11% and may actually be at least 15% because the private insurance companies subcontracting under Medicare attract enrollees who are far healthier than average. Despite these cautionary findings, the Republican-led U.S. Congress is pressing ahead with plans for the greatest privatization scheme in the 40-year history of Medicare, starting off with the current Medicare D drug program. The report is accessible through Congressman Pete Stark's website, house.gov/stark/news. The Massachusetts Senate has passed an amendment to the state budget that would require pharmaceutical company sales representatives to be licensed. The bill would also prevent them from providing entertainment, gifts, payments, or travel to doctors, healthcare facilities, or public officials. If the proposal is approved, licensing fees would be shared between the state attorney general's office, which would use the funds to prosecute Medicaid fraud, and the Board of Registration and Pharmacy, which would use the funds to lower medical error rates. Ken Johnson, the senior vice president for Pharma, the Drug Trade Industry Association, condemned the proposal, claiming it would impose an additional burden on the sharing of new information with physicians. If the amendment is approved, Massachusetts would become the first state in the U.S. to mandate the licensing of drug company representatives. The amendment will appear before the Massachusetts House of Representatives within the next few weeks. A report from the most recent issue of Health Affairs found that for-profit hospitals and nursing homes, on average, provide an inferior quality of care compared with their nonprofit peers. The authors performed a systematic analysis of 162 studies of nonprofit versus for-profit healthcare providers. They concluded that facilities' ownership status makes a significant difference in outcomes and in the cost of healthcare. The overall pattern found that for-profit facilities charge more per patient with similar health problems, provide lower quality care, and create greater barriers to access for those without health insurance and other patients unable to afford costly medical care. Despite the disturbing findings, for-profit ownership is climbing in most sectors of healthcare, from hospitals to hospice care. For example, for-profit hospitals accounted for 11% of the total in the early 1990s, but now account for 16%. The country's largest hospital chain, HCA, is publicly traded on Wall Street, owns 180 hospitals, and generated $24 billion in revenue last year. Another report from Health Affairs presents results from the Joint Canada-U.S. Survey of Health from 2002 to 2003. The survey reveals that health status is relatively similar in the two countries, though Canada has a higher life expectancy. The major difference between the two countries is in the health of the poor and the lower middle class. Americans in the poorest income quintile are more likely to have poor health care and poor health than the poorest Canadians, while the health status of wealthy Canadians was virtually identical to that of the wealthiest Americans. In general, the health of all Canadians was similar to the health status of insured Americans, especially regarding access to medical care, and Canadians experienced fewer unmet health needs overall. The authors noted that the degree of inequality in access to health care is far greater in the United States. Coming up next, an in-depth look at osteoporosis. So stay tuned. Thank you. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. One might expect that people in developed countries might be less active than was the case 100 years ago, given the proliferation and acceptance of labor-saving devices, ranging from automobiles to garage door openers to washing machines. Innumerable types of powered tools and machines have come to dominate the workplace in the U.S. Recreation seems to be changing, with many of us choosing to sit at our computers or watch television. And even when individuals do leave the home, all-terrain vehicles, powerboats, and other motorized forms of recreation have often replaced hiking, swimming, bicycling, or canoeing for many Americans. And, despite efforts to improve the diet of Americans over the last few decades, soda, potato chips, and other foods high in sugar, grease, and salt remain popular mainstays of the American diet. Just over the last 5 years or so, media attention has focused on the increasing prevalence of obesity and diabetes as two consequences of the new American lifestyle. But less attention has been given to another silent problem that is also very much a predictable consequence of these lifestyle changes, osteoporosis. Osteoporosis is a disease of bone that predisposes to fractures, often with devastating consequences to the lives of those it affects. Osteoporosis is especially common among elderly women, who are the fastest growing segment of the population. But it's a condition that develops very gradually over decades, so that even our lifestyle during our youth and early adulthood can have important consequences for the health of our bones later in life. Joining us today to discuss the issue of osteoporosis is Rose Christian. Dr. Christian is a medical doctor in the field of internal medicine, with a special interest in women's health. After practicing for several years, she undertook advanced training in the area of endocrinology and bone physiology at the National Institutes of Health and at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. She currently works at the University of Vermont, where she serves as an assistant professor and helped to create a special clinic which focuses on diseases of bone. Rose Christian, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could start out by describing what is meant by osteoporosis.
Well, there was actually a consensus conference about 10 years ago that came up with a lengthy definition. It's about a paragraph, and I will condense it down to the key elements, which is that it's a skeletal disease characterized by low bone mass, bone fragility, and an increased susceptibility to fracture. And to make that even more simple, it means you don't have a lot of calcium in your bones, you have poor architecture of the bones, making them fragile, and the bottom line is that the bones break easily.
When people think of a diagnosis of, say, cancer, you either have cancer or you don't. But in the case of osteoporosis and bone density in general, I assume this is more of a continuum where there's the entire range from very strong bones at one extreme to perhaps fairly fragile bones at the other extreme. Is that the case?
That's true. When you get a bone density report, often you'll see what's called a T-score, which is just standard deviations from a mean, telling you, are you one standard deviation, two standard deviations below? What would be expected for someone of your age, your gender, and your race? And there have been large epidemiologic studies that say a drop of one standard deviation, for example, increases your fracture risk by twofold. So that's where the standard deviations come in handy. Because the bottom line with measuring bone density is you're just trying to give your patient a sense of fracture risk. Not just measuring bone density, but taking into account all their risk factors. Because the bottom line with osteoporosis is, what's your fracture risk?
Why is it bad to have osteoporosis? What are the consequences? And maybe give listeners a sense of why osteoporosis is important to the public health generally.
Okay. Osteoporosis is very much like high blood pressure and high cholesterol. It's one of the silent diseases, the silent but deadly diseases. Unfortunately, there are no symptoms whatsoever of osteoporosis until you break a bone, and then you're in a lot of pain and disability. Just like with high blood pressure, you have no symptoms until you have that stroke or that heart attack or your kidneys fail. Or with high cholesterol, you have no symptoms of high cholesterol. You can't say, well, I'm kind of feeling a little fatty today in my blood. You know, I think I'll pop a Lipitor. There's no symptoms until you have that, the stroke or the heart attack or the clogging of the arteries. And with osteoporosis, the major consequence is not only fracture, but the effect of fracture on your lifestyle. For example, there's been a lot of focus on hip fracture, and we know that hip fracture definitely shortens your life. For example, in white men who've had a hip fracture, at 2 years after the fracture, 60% of those men are dead. A lot of them never leave the hospital. And the other effect is that most hip fractures actually occur in people who are out in the community, living independently. However, very, very few of those people make it back to their own homes within 6 months of their hip fracture. In most cases, not only do they have surgery and a lengthy hospital stay, but they end up going to a rehab hospital or into nursing home care and never make it home again. So that's an enormous effect. There's also been studies that show the effect on a spouse of someone who survives a hip fracture, and it can be as bad as having a spouse with terminal cancer or a massive heart attack or an organ transplant in terms of the effects on the surviving spouse. So the effect on lifestyle and also on the public health costs are huge. There are also more subtle effects, for example, with vertebral fractures, fractures in the spine, that people don't tend to realize how debilitating these are. With the compression of one vertebrae after another, the spine becomes curved. You lose lung volume. Literally, you can have your lower rib cage sitting on the top of your pelvic bone, and you have a stoop forward posture that sets off the whole center of gravity and balance for a person and actually can predispose to hip fractures because they're more likely to fall. There's also a lot of chronic pain with spinal fractures that people aren't aware of. So we take those just as seriously as the hip fractures.
And the thing about osteoporosis is that it's very common and has a great public health impact because it's just a very common event and affects many people. And could you just talk a little bit about age groups that are involved and what some of the risk factors are to where this would be more likely to occur?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of data, and if you're really interested in this, I would recommend the Surgeon General's report published in 2004. That's on a website, and they actually did a great job summarizing many, many huge epidemiologic studies from the previous 10 years or so. What I can tell you now is that with each decade, the incidence of osteoporosis in both men and women is rising. The incidence of hip fracture is rising. As of 2002, in the Surgeon General's report, there is an estimated 44 million Americans with either osteoporosis or very low bone density. That's a lot. And the other thing to keep in mind is that not only is bone density low, but the fall risk increases as you get older. And this is an exponential increase starting about age 60, with the greatest risk of falls in people 80 and over.
And osteoporosis is more common among women. And why is that? What is it about female physiology that makes women more predisposed? And what is the ratio between men and women and involvement with osteoporosis?
Okay. Well, I can give you the numbers. Literally, in terms of measured bone density, okay, a woman of age 50 or older is more than twice as likely to have either low bone mass or osteoporosis on a bone density measurement. In terms of lifelong fracture risk, from age 50 on, one out of two women will have a fragility fracture, meaning a wrist, a vertebrae, or the hip, meaning the kind of fracture that occurs with minimal trauma, not in a motor vehicle accident or, you know, falling off the roof, whereas it's approximately one in five for men.
And is it known what it is about the quality of women's bones over the life cycle?
There's a number of things there. One is that women just have smaller bones. and it's just a matter of mechanics. Also, the hip angle is different in women and in men, and that can affect whether you fracture when you fall on a hip or not also. The last factor is that not only do women start out with lower bone density, there is this rapid drop in the first 5 years after menopause, that men have a more gradual decline in bone density as they age, and women have this kind of radical drop in the first 5 years of losing estrogen, and then it tapers off to a steadier decline below that. So not only do women start out with smaller bones, but they have an accelerated loss. And then lastly, there's cultural effects too, is that women tend to be less physically active, particularly in high school. Starting in high school and going on, there's a real drop off in girls' physical activity level. Women tend to have less physically active jobs. And in other cultures, particularly in the Middle East and in parts of Asia, women are much less likely to get sun exposure, and there's a huge epidemic of vitamin D deficiency, for example, in the Middle East, where women are so covered up, literally.
And you're raising several lifestyle issues that might affect this. Sun exposure allowing vitamin D to be created.
Mm-hmm.
And also you bring up the issue of exercise and activity level. So I was wondering if you could maybe focus on those a minute. Say nutrition and immobility, are they felt to be very important risk factors? A parallel epidemic that is occurring in the United States, everyone knows about by now, is to do with obesity and diabetes. And a lot of that is due to lack of exercise. And when it comes to osteoporosis, in some ways there's somewhat a similar risk factor in terms of activity level. And I was wondering if you could talk about that. Is it known, for example, if we're much less active now, is it predicted that osteoporosis will become more common in the future? And is it known whether it was a lot less common in the past when both men and women did a lot more physical activity?
Oh, those are all really good questions. Well, starting with the physical activity, in terms of adolescence, we know that the peak bone mass is accrued in your mid-20s, certainly no later than age 30, even with someone with a delayed puberty. And so those teenage and years and early 20s are absolutely critical in terms of physical activity, adequate vitamin D, adequate calcium in the diet. And unfortunately, it tends to be the time when, for women in particular, this seems to start as soon as they hit high school, the physical activity level really drops, participation in sports, activity outside of school, all of that. For men, it seems to occur a little later. A lot of them remain active through high school and immediately after or in college, and then they get out in the workforce and they become very sedentary. But the other issue has become the whole shift in our diet, where dairy products and more high protein products are being replaced by basically soda, various flavored carbonated drinks, flavored waters, etc. And that's been a huge shift. It's not that soda, for example, in itself is bad, although I do think it is not a great drink, but it's literally just displacing other fluids in the diet that have calcium, vitamin D, protein. So that's the issue in adolescence, and that's a very hard group to reach, and it's a hard group to affect behavior change in. Then later on, there's several parts of the sedentary lifestyle. One is, as Westerners, we tend to sit a lot, and we don't squat, we don't get down on the ground, compared to the Middle East and Asian societies where, if you're in China and you're at a bus stop, everyone's squatting. Even people in suits with briefcases are squatting, waiting for their bus to come. So there's a lot of up and down, and they keep their hip flexors very strong. Same thing in Japan and other cultures where the bedding is on the ground, the tables are very low, etc. Whereas in this culture, you're sitting all the time, your bed's about 3 feet off the floor, so there isn't a lot of need to keep those hip flexors strong. And it's very common for me to see people in the office who can't get out of a chair without pushing off the arms by the time they're age 60. It's really striking. Atrophy in those core muscles and those hip flexor muscles. And we know that losing that strength there predisposes to falls right there, let alone the effect of muscle mass on bone strength itself.
And is it known whether the consumption of salt and also eating a high-protein diet that's not dairy, like a lot of meat and chicken, if those are favorable or unfavorable?
A high-sodium diet causes loss of calcium in the urine. What happens is that the kidneys are definitely trying to get rid of the high sodium load, and as they pump that out into the urine, the calcium follows along. And it's also a consequence of diuretics. Certain diuretics that cause you to lose sodium through the urine, we will also increase losses of calcium. So a high sodium diet is definitely a bad thing. And there are even cases where when we're measuring people who seem to have a lot of calcium losses in the urine. So that is a change that you can make. The other issue with protein is that it's somewhat controversial, but some animal proteins, for example, will have a high phosphorus load. High protein diets are hard in the kidneys. Anything that's hard in the kidneys is going to affect bones down the road.
So overall, it sounds like it might be favorable to eat a lot of dairy and vegetables and maybe less protein and sodium, and that would be a more favorable diet for to prevent osteoporosis.
Definitely the low sodium diet for sure. And in terms of the protein, you certainly want to have enough to support your muscle mass, but not these very high loads, that's correct, that cause, you know, excessive urinary losses and strains on the kidneys. And then in terms of dairy, that really depends. Again, culturally, there are a lot of people out there that just can't tolerate lactose and dairy products. And fortunately, it's getting easier to find calcium-fortified soy products, et cetera. You know, whether it's soy milk or other forms where you can get both a calcium and a protein source.
There's been a tremendous focus on osteoporosis among women, but this whole problem is so common that even though it may be more common among women, it's still an issue for men. Is that correct? And how do you approach that issue?
It's a huge issue for men, and I feel really strongly about this, that men need to be aware that they're at risk for osteoporosis. One of the real difficulties with getting a sense of how common osteoporosis is and what some of the causes are in men is that they are much less likely to volunteer in clinical trials than women, and they're also very reluctant to have bone density measured or even just to see their primary care doctor about issues like this. There are certain subgroups of men that are incredibly high risk, and one of these are men with prostate cancer who have been treated in any way that reduces their testosterone levels, because this is just like women going through menopause. They have a profound loss of bone density, and they have a greatly increased fracture risk, at least fourfold increased fracture risk compared to other men of the same age. And very few of them are aware of that. And one of the big public health issues is the insurers and Medicare have not caught on to the fact that osteoporosis is common. It's 1 out of 5 men over age 50, even higher in certain subgroups. It's 1 out of 2 men with prostate cancer will have a fragility fracture. And yet there is no reimbursement for routine screening, and it's very hard to get a bone density treatment or even just bone density testing paid for in these men. There are groups that are lobbying for this, like the National Osteoporosis Foundation, are really actively lobbying, but it's a big issue.
Now, you've mentioned, both of us have mentioned earlier in this interview, that osteoporosis is diagnosed by actually measuring bone density, that there's no way to measure, to diagnose osteoporosis just with blood testing.
That's
so
correct.
So, talk about the bone density measurement. Is it fairly accurate? Do you have to worry about the quality of the densitometer at your hospital, or is it, or at any hospital in general? Are most of these machines fairly accurate nowadays?
Okay. Well, there's a number of different ways to measure bone density by a machine, and they basically fall into three imaging types. One is ultrasound, which uses sound waves. And the other is DEXA, DXA, which is a very low radiation technique. And then lastly, there is quantitative CT scanning, which is a very high radiation technique. All of the big studies showing the efficacy of osteoporosis therapy and looking at the prevalence, you know, how common osteoporosis is, all the big epidemiologic studies, and the studies in which we come up with these standard deviations and risk factors for fracture are based on using DEXA. And basically, a DEXA scan means that you lie on a table. There is a very focused collimated low-intensity x-ray beam that goes through your spine, and then it's picked up by a detector that you're lying on top of on the table. It takes about 10 minutes. The radiation dose is very low. It's about 1/1000th of a chest x-ray. And that's particularly important when you're talking about looking at bone density in the lower spine, which is in your lower back, in your pelvis. So you have a very low radiation exposure to your kidneys and your ovaries and other vital organs in that area. So that's what we tend to recommend.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. My guest today is Rose Christian, an expert in the field of osteoporosis. After the break, we'll be discussing the prevention and treatment of osteoporosis, including her view on all the drugs we've seen advertised on television to treat the disease. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guest today is Rose Christian, and we've been discussing osteoporosis, a silent disease which leads to spine and hip fractures, which often have devastating impacts on the lives of their often elderly victims. During the first part of today's interview, we discussed the causes of osteoporosis and how to diagnose the disease. For the remainder of the interview, we'll discuss what strategies are useful in preventing osteoporosis and also other strategies useful in preventing fractures. Now back to the interview.
For many public health problems, we would have separate discussions about how to prevent the problem as opposed to how we would treat it. Mm-hmm. So an obvious example is a pap smear to detect cervical cancer versus whatever radiation, radiotherapy, or surgery to actually treat it if it were identified. But in the case of osteoporosis, there's a good deal of overlap between what to do to prevent it and then how it's treated. So I was wondering if you could talk about the approach to preventing and treating osteoporosis.
Okay. Well, The approach to preventing starts really early. I mean, it starts in adolescence, really. Encouraging people to remain active, encouraging people to keep calcium in their diet, to avoid a high-sodium diet, all the things you're kind of fighting against the tide in American culture, for example. And then all through adult life, the importance of remaining active. But lastly, as you get older, really over age 50, we're looking at fall prevention. Really, as you're getting older, you're looking at fall prevention because there's a certain amount of bone loss that can be difficult to recover, and you can have fragile bones, but if you can keep your fall risk low, you can prevent a lot of fractures there.
So it sounds like on the one hand, you want to remain active and get exercise to help keep the bones strong, but on the other hand, you have to be, especially at advanced ages, you need to be maybe more careful to be safe about how you're being active.
Absolutely. And there are a few other things I should mention that start in adolescence too, and that's smoking and drinking. We know that tobacco is toxic to bones. Women who smoke and men who smoke have significantly lower bone density, And women who smoke also tend to have an earlier menopause, so they have a longer period of time where they don't have the protective effect of estrogen on their bones. Alcohol is a double whammy because it is toxic to osteoblasts, which are the cells in bone that actually build up bone and make it thicker. And it also greatly increases falls, as you can imagine. And then lastly, alcohol tends to replace other nutrition in the diet. So the lifestyle parts are key. And then lastly, patients need to be aware as they get older that a lot of the medications they're prescribed for both acute and chronic conditions can affect their bones. And there are a couple big categories that should be mentioned. One is anti-seizure medications can interrupt the vitamin D metabolism pathway and cause vitamin D deficiency, which over time can cause significant loss of bone mass. Another group is certain diuretics that cause wasting of sodium and calcium in the urine. And over time, they can cause significant bone loss as well.
These are medicines that take fluid out of, get rid of fluid.
That's right. What patients often call water pills. That's right. There are other categories. For example, the antiretroviral medications that patients with AIDS are taking chronically now that patients with AIDS are really living with you know, HIV infection as a chronic illness. They're taking the antiretrovirals for years, and we're discovering that a lot of them are developing very low bone density due to the effect of those medications, again, on vitamin D metabolism and calcium absorption.
And then maybe the most common of all would be corticosteroid therapy.
Absolutely. You shouldn't overlook that. That is the most common, and we not only have people taking steroids chronically for lung diseases, particularly asthma, but more and more patients taking them for immunosuppression after transplant and arthritic diseases, et cetera. And people have to be aware that even the short courses of steroids that you take for maybe a week or 10 days for severe bronchitis or a bad case of poison ivy, if you're repeating that two or three times a year, year after year, that has a cumulative long-term effect on your bones.
Putting together the various risk factors you've talked about, and maybe we could try to do that. You've just mentioned a variety of medical treatments where the medicines themselves have a detrimental effect on bone density. You mentioned advanced age as a major issue. You've mentioned gender, that women are more likely to have osteoporosis and more likely to have fractures. And the more general issue of poor nutrition and being inactive. You start adding this up and you're talking about large numbers of people. So what is, in your view, what should be the recommendation for who should be screened for osteoporosis?
Well, that's a good question. The current recommendations are not necessarily what your insurance company or Medicare will reimburse. The National Osteoporosis Foundation, you know, encourages every woman over 60 to at least get their first baseline screening, and every man over age 70 to get their first baseline screening. That doesn't mean that Medicare will pay for it, okay, or that your insurance company will. Private insurers tend to be a little better, but it, again, that varies. Medicare will cover for bone density screening every 2 years for women 65 and older, which is great, but not for men at this time.
No screenings at all?
No. We also have specific recommendations for high-risk groups. And for example, anyone who's had a solid organ transplant, we know that osteoporosis can set in within 6 months of a transplant, and the current recommendations of the organ transplant, the National Registry, is that you should have bone density measured at baseline, either just before or right after your transplant, and then every year indefinitely. Another high-risk group is men with prostate cancer who are on what's called androgen deprivation therapy, meaning any kind of treatment, pill or surgery that reduces their testosterone levels should have bone density testing on a regular basis. And then lastly, there's a huge group now of women who are breast cancer survivors who, instead of taking tamoxifen or chemotherapy, are taking a new class of drugs called aromatase inhibitors. And some of these brand names are Aromacin or Femara. And they really, really drop estrogen levels in the body way below menopausal levels and have been shown to greatly reduce bone density in the women taking them. And the oncologists have become quite aware of this now, and they're checking bone density every year on women taking this, even women in their 40s and 50s, if they're breast cancer survivors on those drugs.
And what about people, say younger people in general? Should young people be screened for osteoporosis, or does it not turn out to be cost-effective?
Basically, studies have shown it's just not cost-effective unless they are in a particularly high-risk group. For example, a young person who's chronically ill, who is chronically on steroids, who has a chronic illness like cystic fibrosis that's been known to be associated with low bone density and high fracture risk, or are a cancer survivor on one of these therapies that reduces bone density. And the bottom line is, because you can find low bone density, but typically in people under age 50, the fracture risk is so low, largely because they're more fit and they have a lower fall risk.
So the recommendation for younger people is not to screen them with a bone mineral study, but on the other hand, to encourage them to take measures that would tend to protect their bones.
That's correct, unless they're in one of those high-risk populations or have had a fragility fracture. For example, I had a patient who was a 35-year-old police officer, and she'd had her ovaries removed and basically gone into menopause in her middle 20s because of another illness, and had gone 10 years with no estrogen on board, and also had taken steroids for asthma, and she fell chasing someone in a football stadium and broke her wrist. And that led to an evaluation, and she actually had osteoporosis at the age of 35. But if she hadn't, had that fragility fracture, it probably wouldn't have led to that kind of screening. But overall, yeah, the bottom line is work on preventive measures in the younger people. Studies have shown there are two issues with starting interventions early. First of all, if you take someone who's only 35 or 40 and you put them on a powerful drug for their bone density before age 50, and someone whose fracture risk may be relatively low, you're committing them to decades and decades of treatment, ongoing monitoring, and we haven't had any of these osteoporosis drugs around long enough to know what the long-term effects are, not more than 20 years. The most popular group of drugs is bisphosphonates, and some of those names are like Actonel, Fosamax, Boniva. You've probably seen them on television. And at the best, we have 20-year outcomes data and safety data on those.
And they seem to look okay so far?
They're looking very good. They're looking very good so far. The nice thing about this group called bisphosphonates is that they're basically inert. They were developed during World War II as industrial solvents, and only later found that the pyrophosphate in this industrial solvent would substitute in a stronger way for the phosphorus that's actually in your bones bound to calcium. So it would bind in, take the place of your native phosphorus, and actually stick around longer and be a lot stronger. And they don't interact with other drugs. They're pretty inert. The only issues that have come up with them very recently are something called phosy-jaw. And it's being seen, there have been only a couple hundred cases reported in people who get intravenous therapy year after year, usually for a minimum of 2 years, month after month.
With the bisphosphonate.
With a bisphosphonate. These are not the pills you take over the counter. These are very powerful intravenous forms of the drug. And they're being given to patients with cancer, with bone lesions or bone metastases. So we know that giving these drugs year after year, month after month, in very high doses to people with malignancies can have some side effects.
But overall, this group of bisphosphonates, the most commonly used drugs, have so far seem to have a pretty good track record up to 20
years.
Very
good safety profile, yes.
Calcium and vitamin D have a big role, and you generally want patients to take those medications.
We encourage maximizing calcium intake in the diet as much as possible before encouraging supplements, because compliance with supplements isn't a whole lot better than compliance with any other pill that you recommend, whether it's prescribed or not. So we focus a lot on dietary change and reducing things in the diet that cause loss of calcium in the urine. For example, trying to cut back on caffeine, trying to cut back on sodium, that kind of thing. But yeah, I talk a lot about supplements. I talk about the right way to take them. They should always be taken with food because they need an acid environment to be absorbed. Or alternatives, if you have a low acid stomach because you're on medication, alternative forms of calcium. Vitamin D is also a very big thing that we talk about, because a lot of people don't know that if you take a calcium supplement but you have a vitamin D deficiency, you won't absorb it, since it's vitamin D that causes the calcium to be absorbed from your intestine.
After you've identified a patient with osteoporosis, say it's fairly bad osteoporosis, you undoubtedly give them every measure that you can. You probably tell them about the nutritional issues that we've discussed. Undoubtedly, you tell them to try to be active in any safe way they can. And you undoubtedly start them on medication. Let's just, for example, say it's calcium, vitamin D, and a bisphosphonate. After you've started a treatment program, if you get repeat bone mineral measurements at a later time, do you actually want to see their bone mineral density improve, or are you just hoping it won't get any, whatever got them to be that bad, at least it won't get worse? What are you
exactly
really looking for?
We are absolutely, we see a treatment success as no further loss of bone density, because the inevitable decline is to get maybe 1% loss per year. And if we can see stable bone density or no significant change, let's say a less than 2 or 3% decline, because that's within the measurement error of even the best densitometers, then we are pleased. And the unfortunate thing is I also get a lot of referrals either from anxious self-referred patients or from primary care doctors who say, oh, you know, the bone density is exactly what it was a year or two ago when I started this. And I say, that's great, because they had to have been progressively losing bone to get to the point where you started that medication and treatment regimen. So the fact that they've stopped losing bone is success. And if you can actually regain some bone density, so much the better.
You mentioned earlier, and most people know, that osteoporosis itself doesn't cause symptoms, and therefore the issue is, when you talk about why it's important, you mentioned how devastating a fracture can be, especially to older people who are, and they constitute the most common group that suffer hip fractures and vertebral fractures, which often are really life-altering events. So when you look at the issue of osteoporosis and you're treating patients in your clinic, do you confine yourself to say, well, I'm a hormone specialist, I'm just going to deal with osteoporosis? Or do you really look at it as a larger issue of preventing falls and keeping the person safe and active without actually breaking a bone and suffering those consequences?
I definitely fall into the fall prevention camp. And I carry it over through my outpatient practice, because I see all kinds of endocrine issues, not just patients with osteoporosis, but patients with thyroid cancer and diabetes and other hormone problems. But also in my hospital practice, I spend about a week out of every month doing hospital consults, and most of these are on patients in the hospital with diabetes, and the doctors there need help controlling their blood sugars. I ask every patient I see in the hospital, do you fall? How often do you fall? Have you ever broken a bone because of a fall? What can we do to help you prevent falls? And these aren't patients I'm being asked to see for osteoporosis. These are just patients in the hospital, because I think it's a great time to do some education and make some interventions. I ask every patient I see in my office practice as well.
And what kinds of interventions are helpful to prevent falls? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there've actually been studies that have looked at this, and it really is worth asking about falls, because it is possible to prevent them. And a couple of things that actually have been looked at and proven effective and published are as simple as encouraging patients to have cataract surgery, because having impaired vision is a huge risk factor for falls. Another one is having patients wear something called yak tracks. This is a study done in Wisconsin by one of my colleagues there, who had a group of elderly patients wear these grippy, stretchy things on the bottom of their shoes in the winter. We get a lot of ice and snow in Wisconsin, just like Vermont, and kept a log of falls and made a significant difference in falls. You can have professionals come into your home, and we have them in Chittenden County. There are public health nurses that will go in just about every county in the state, and will go in and do a fall risk assessment will go through and say you need grab bars here, you need to remove the scatter rugs here, this floor is slippery, you need better lighting here. There's a few really simple things that you can do. The other thing is in terms of going through your medication list, there are certain medications that have been definitely associated with a higher risk of falls. And some of them are simple as anything that makes you get up at night to urinate. A lot of falls occur when a patient's getting up at night and going to the bathroom. It's dark. Their blood pressure may fall a little bit as they're getting up. They may be half awake. Anything like a water pill that makes you get up and urinate at night increases your fall risk. Other things that, anything that reduces blood pressure, anything that makes you a little fuzzy like a painkiller can increase your risk of falling. And even in my department, anything that lowers your blood sugar, the blood sugar gets too low, you can be more likely to fall as well.
And one of the problems with the fall issue is that some of the main problems that would tend to lead to osteoporosis also might lead to falls. For example, people with arthritis of their legs or their back might be less active and therefore more likely to have osteoporosis, and maybe because of the arthritis more likely to fall. And I guess the same for neurologic illness, where people can't really walk, it might lead to deterioration in bones and they're more likely to fall. So there might be many illnesses like that where it lead to both being at higher risk for both of those.
That's very true. Particularly you mentioned neurologic illness. People who don't have good sensation in their feet or who don't have good balance, anything that impairs balance or that causes weakening of their major muscle groups are much more likely to fall. And people who've had strokes or any kind of impairment like that are just going to be a lot more sedentary or in fact can be completely immobilized. And we know that people who've had spinal cord injuries or strokes where they literally can't move their lower extremities start losing bone density within 2 weeks of an injury like that. It can happen very rapidly.
From watching television these days, you might get the impression that the main thing that you need to know about osteoporosis is that there are certain medicines that are available to treat it, and that probably most of the people over the age of 60 in this country, their main problem is they're not taking osteoporosis drugs. So, and we're supposed to go ask our doctor, doctor, please, why aren't I on one of these drugs? So I guess the question I have is, when you see this advertising, what are your thoughts about it?
Well, I'm very concerned about it because it not only affects patients, but it affects doctors as well, particularly doctors who are not specialists in osteoporosis or are very busy primary care practitioners. And studies have shown that having a patient come in and ask for a specific drug really does influence a physician's prescribing behavior. And I think what tends to happen is the patient comes in and says, gee, I don't want to end up like my mother. She shrank 5 inches and she's all bent over and she broke a hip when she was 80. Do you think I should start this now, start this pill now? And it kind of subverts the whole discussion about the importance of calcium, vitamin D, exercise, cutting back on cigarettes, not drinking so much. Gee, what pills are you taking that could increase your fall risk? What's going on at home? These other kinds of things. It's like, gee, you're right. You're probably at risk and your bone density is a little low. Let's start the Fosamax or the Actonel or the Beneva. And it's very concerning to me. I've also had patients come in to me who were taking calcium and vitamin D and exercising. Then they got started on a drug, and they come back to me a year or two later. And I say, well, how come you're not taking your calcium anymore? Why did you stop your walking program? And they'll say, well, I don't have to. I'm taking my osteoporosis drug. And that's sad.
So the point is that, especially at younger ages, the important thing is not to view yourself as drug deficient if you are concerned about osteoporosis, but to take the lifestyle actions that would prevent it.
Absolutely. That's got to be the approach. It's kind of like the people who say, well, I'm on Lipitor so I can go out and have the steak and fries, you know, because I'm on the drug that's going to, I think it gives people the feeling that they're kind of off the hook. And even under the best circumstances, under carefully controlled trials where the patients are reminded to take the pill and they're carefully selected to be compliant with the medication, the fracture risk is reduced at best 50% by taking any of these drugs, which is still great, but it's not 100%. There's another 50% or more out there that's up to you.
So just one last time, can you describe what types of lifestyle factors would tend to protect people from osteoporosis?
Well, if we're just going to focus on lifestyle, I say remain physically active. Walk as much as you can. Take the stairs as much as you can, including in your own home. Have the laundry room in the basement and go up and down stairs with a laundry basket. Don't park so close to work. Anything. People will quibble with me and say, well, doctor, should I run or should I walk, or what about swimming and biking? I heard they're not as good. The bottom line is keep your muscle groups strong and stay physically active. Secondly would be limit toxins in your diet, whether it's high sodium, tobacco, high amounts of caffeine, which we didn't actually get to because high caffeine in the diet also causes loss of calcium in the urine. Limit alcohol. And then focus on calcium and adequate vitamin D. Whether you're a dairy person or not, find another way to get it.
And can you refer listeners to some websites that are useful on the issue of osteoporosis and falls?
Yeah, absolutely. There are several. The easiest one is hormone.org. And this is the Hormone Foundation, which is a nonprofit. Not only is there a lot of information on this site, including recent results of studies about all kinds of hormone disorders, a lot of it relates to osteoporosis in both men and women. And they have over 50 one-page fact sheets that are translated into four languages. And you can just click on it. For example, they've got a great fact sheet on osteoporosis in men. And it's in English and Spanish and French and, I don't know, Japanese or something. Very, very nice and easy and accessible. Another one is the National Osteoporosis Foundation. And this is an education and lobbying group, and that's nof.org. And they're working very hard in Congress to get reimbursement for bone density screening in men, that kind of thing.
Rose Christian, thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
You're very welcome.
Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. One final note. After hosting 66 consecutive shows over the last 5 years, I will be taking a 4-month leave from Public Health Radio. Andy Coates, a brilliant physician with a tremendous amount of talent and a broad array of interests, will be hosting the show. So join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.